you are visiting with us, then we are working our way steadily through the Gospel of John, which was written that we may believe, we may understand that Jesus is the Son of God. He is the Messiah. It's not written from a neutral perspective. It's written very clearly to try and layer upon layer the evidence for who Jesus is. And we've reached the second half of chapter 2, where we're going to read from verse 12. John chapter 2, at verse 12. After this, he, that is Jesus, went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples. There they stayed for a few days. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found them selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove from the temple courts both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Then the Jews responded to him, "What sign can you show to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." They replied, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. And after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scriptures and the word that Jesus had spoken. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. Let me invite you to take your Bible in your hands, to have the words we read earlier from John chapter 2 in front of you, as we think today about what these words from verse 12 onwards are teaching us. Well, if these events had happened today, it would trend on social media with hashtag temple trouble, wouldn't it? Mainstream media would have a correspondent reporting live from the scene. The correspondent would be talking, no doubt, over some clips that we'd be able to see about the carnage ourselves, clips that were recorded perhaps on other people's mobile phones, as it were, the clips of animals out of control, people shouting and screaming, trying to get everything back in control, the image of money men on their hands and knees, grabbing whatever they could that's fallen all on the floor because carnage has come about, and not worrying about being trampled by the animals, the monies. The money's the thing for them. And occasionally a clip would have the shell-shocked look of a visitor to Jerusalem. Perhaps this Gentile visitor, this non-Jew, has spent the last years planning coming to the very heart of where he can find God and look at the mess round about him. Perhaps there's a final closing clip of the confrontation between Jesus and the authorities, and the correspondent is there, "Oh, we've just had an official response from the temple authorities," and let me read it for you. Well, we don't quite know what's happened, but we can assure you that normal service will resume soon. Normal service. Well, that's a problem, isn't it? Normal service at the temple is the problem for which Jesus is the solution. And so John, the writer of this gospel, he's taken us from Cana in Galilee to the capital of the country. He's taken us from that first miraculous sign that revealed something of who Jesus is to his disciples, right into the capital city, where for the first time since his public ministry began, he comes to the place where all of the people of God are called to come and worship God, especially at the festivals, especially at Passover time. And so in his capacity now, as the one sent from God, he arrives in Jerusalem. And what we're going to study is what unfolds as he gets there. This morning, I want us to notice two or three things about what we might see. I want to kick off by focusing about what Jesus sees, or what Jesus saw when he came to Jerusalem that day. First thing Jesus saw, he saw a toxic combination of injustice mixed with hypocrisy. A toxic combination of injustice mixed with hypocrisy. If you were a pilgrim heading for Jerusalem, well, your focus, you know, your sat-nav was not just simply the city, and your sat-nav is not the sights of the city. Your sat-nav is not your accommodation. It's not even perhaps family members that might be there. That's not where your heart is, because if you're a pilgrim, your heart is based on the temple of God, that you're going up, not simply to Jerusalem, you're going up to the temple. You're going to the place where God has promised to be. It's at the very heart of everything that the people of God had looked to and orientated their lives around in that generation. Or rather, that's the way it should be. If you were there for the first time, you'd probably go there thinking that this is going to be a place where there's going to be this solemn dignity. There's going to be the murmur of prayer. There's going to be this holy adoration of God. And yet, when you get there, you're going to find a totally different scene, aren't you? Because when you get there, it's more like a cattle mart. And there's animals with the sounds and the smells of animals. And there's the bartering that's taking place over these animals. And there's the money that's been exchanged in the whole place. And the place is chaos. I don't know how many of you have been to an auction mart in your day. I don't know how many of you have been out to Dingwall to a mart and there's a sale on. But especially when there's a livestock sale. You know the guy at the front who's speaking so fast. I know, ironic, coming from me, talking about anyone speaking fast. But the guy's speaking so fast, he's almost incomprehensible. And you're thinking, well, it's actually not that dissimilar an image to what you're going to actually have here in Jerusalem. You see, the religious authorities, they'd got this sewn up. If you were looking for business advice, setting out in a business, how to make money, well, speaking to these guys might not be a bad idea. Because as far as they were concerned, under the guise of godliness, under the guise of we want to uphold a holy worship, they said, listen, it's only inspected, authorized animals that could come for sacrifice. And so what they would do is that these animals would come, they'd either be bought nearby, en route, they would come and they'd say, no, I'm sorry, that one's not good enough, you're going to have to buy this one. Aye, but I've already just bought this, sorry, that's not good enough. Remember, it's God you're thinking of here. You have to buy this one. Sometimes 100 times more expensive. They got it sewn up. So they come with their money. I'm sorry, we don't take that. That's not legal tender here. You need this money. Well, where am I going to get that money? Over that guy over there. And of course, the exchange rates, well, that's kind of fixed to quite a considerable degree. And so the money that was made was huge. Records from the Roman Empire talk about millions of pounds, literally millions of pounds in our currency was taken from the authorities at one stage. Such was the racketeering that was going on. And so this is what Jesus sees. And on top of that, there's this, on top of the hypocrisy of what's meant to be done here, there's the whole injustice, because all this chaos is happening in the one part of the temple precinct where the Gentiles, the non-Jews, were allowed to come and worship God. The Jews were meant to be a light to the nations. The people of the nations should be able to look at the Jewish people and think, no, they've got access to God, and they should want that for themselves. And so if they did, and they made this pilgrimage, and they're coming to the temple, they're finding that they can't actually worship in the place that's been set aside for their worship. And so there is the injustice of seeking a real religion and a real relationship with God and being confronted with a false one. And there is the hypocrisy of somehow in the name of religion making money when this should be a place of prayer and worship. You know, many people today will talk about organized religion, and this is a reason they take nothing to do with Christianity. And they'll take nothing to do with it because, you know, organized religion is about control and it's completely hypocritical, and the injustices that they let go, and, you know, it's just all corrupt. And you think, well, listen, there's an answer to that in the sense Jesus hates hypocrisy too. And Jesus hates injustice. And what we would do is that we would say to folks for whom organized religion is their excuse, well, listen, Jesus didn't let injustice or hypocrisy pass him by. When he saw that in society, he didn't just walk on by. When he saw it where there should be truth, and God-honoring reverend worship, he's not going to stand by idly either. Because you know what? You know the greatest injustice and the greatest hypocrisy is not giving God the worshipful honor and reverence that he's due. And you say, well, that's worse than exploitation. Jesus did not agree or just ignore an exploitation or any other things that take place. But there is a passion and a zeal preeminently for the worship of God. Well, Jesus sees a toxic combination of hypocrisy and injustice. Second thing Jesus sees is that he sees opposition for the first time. Well, the religious authorities, they're not going to be able to just ignore what's taking place. And so they come and they confront Jesus. These are the people who had overseen the scenario where the very reason for the building existing, the worship of God, that was being compromised. Now, interesting, they don't come to Jesus and arrest him with their temple police. They don't come to Jesus and deny the fact that he's done the right thing. And they don't come to Jesus and dismiss him as a crank. All these things are significant. I'll leave you to think about them later on this afternoon. But they don't do any of these things. They come to Jesus, and as far as they're concerned, the one issue that they want clarity on is authority. He says to them, get out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market. What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? Sign? And they're probably thinking, well, prophets showed signs. If this is a message from God, let him show a sign. Well, the clear temple should have been a sign. But he says more than that. This temple's your focus. We'll destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. And they're, what, are you mad? 46 years it's taken. Are you mad? Well, I mean, this is the creator of the universe. It could take him 46 seconds if he chose to do so. But he's not talking about the physical building, is he? But what he is saying is, listen, destroy this temple, I will rebuild it. He is claiming authority as the Lord of the temple to do what he has done. Incidentally, he is the Lord, the King, and head of his church. It's why we say this at the start of a church service, reminding ourselves who we've come to focus on. He's claiming this authority to do this. But more than that, he's in this reference here when he says, destroy this temple, verse 19, I will raise it again in 3 days. He's not simply talking about a building, he's talking about himself. He's talking about being the meeting place between God and man. And he's talking about what they're going to do, that they actually are going to destroy him. But that he is going to come back, he's going to be raised from the dead. And his disciples remembered these words and attribute it to zeal. But his enemies remembered these words, and they would throw these words at him. At the end of the gospel, and as we've got it recorded in Matthew's gospel, in his trial, oh, this is a guy who's going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Again, not getting what he's on about. And even as he's on the cross, Matthew chapter 27, rebuild the temple in 3 days, come down now from the cross. Really? The opposition that's going to see him destroyed begins now. Jesus sees a toxic combination of hypocrisy and injustice. Jesus sees opposition for the first time. Third truth this passage tells us, Jesus sees their hearts and yours and mine. So this cleansing of the temple, that's what this whole episode is called, the cleansing of the temple, is joined, as verse 23 tells us, by many signs that Jesus performed in Jerusalem. So there's miracles, there's the cleansing, and there's the miracles, plural. And so there's a following that Jesus now gains. Many people believed in his name. Verse 23, you say, well, that's great, isn't it? This is good. The movement has begun. The mission is beginning to gather people who are going to be part of this work. This is great. And yet the passage goes on to say it's actually not that great because it tells us that Jesus would not entrust himself to them because he knew all people. He didn't need any testimony about mankind. He knew what was in each person. So here's the thing. Verse 23, they believed in his name. Verse 24, Jesus would not entrust himself to them. Believed and entrusted, the same word. Same word that's used. They believed in him. He did not believe in them. Why? Well, Psalm 94 tells us that the Lord knows what we're thinking. The Lord knows our hearts. The Lord knows us. And when Jesus walked on this earth, he had that precise supernatural understanding of what was going on the inside with individuals. We're going to see this in chapter 3 with Nicodemus, and chapter 4 with the woman in the well, chapter 5 with a disabled man waiting to be healed. Jesus knows exactly what's going on. He knows what's going on the outside, and he knows what's going on the inside. And he knows whether what is on the inside is a genuine, authentic connection with him, a genuine, authentic trust and belief in who he is. He knows whether they're playing at it or not. And many of the people here, well, they were just being caught up with the enthusiasm of what was unfolding. There was no real substance. I suppose we could put it this way. There was no real connection to Jesus. They were almost playing at it. And the uncomfortable reality, because Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever, is that Jesus knows exactly what's going on in your life and my life today. He sees right through the outside externals. He sees right into our hearts, and he sees whether we're playing at it when it comes to a relationship with him, or whether there's a genuine connection to Jesus Christ. So when Jesus arrives in Jerusalem for the first time, he sees injustice and hypocrisy. He sees opposition. And he sees right through the people who are moved by what he's doing. That's what Jesus sees. Second truth here is what the disciples see. I want you to look at verse 17 for this truth. After Jesus has caused this or performed this cleansing, his disciples remembered that it's written, verse 17, "Zeal for your house will consume me." From Psalm 69. Put yourself in the shoes of the disciples. As you approach Jerusalem, there must have been a sense of anticipation. You've come to understand that this is the Messiah. You have seen his miraculous power. The Messiah is now coming to where the Messiah needs to be, Jerusalem. And you are there with him. And humanly speaking, that sense of anticipation, of excitement about what might unfold with the Messiah in Jerusalem at the temple, it must have been quite something. And I'm pretty sure none of the disciples would have guessed that this is how the Messiah would enter Jerusalem and would enter the temple. Bear in mind, Jesus had been in Jerusalem on many occasions from the age of 12 onwards. He'd been there. And sometimes we actually do fixate a little inappropriately about what happens here and again at the end of Jesus' ministry in the temple and think, oh, well, whenever Jesus was in the temple, he caused carnage. He was there to just give them the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. He did in these two occasions, but he was there a number of occasions when he did not respond. And we need to, you know, just bear that in mind. But here he is responding, and they're looking at him. And I can imagine if there was another clip that we were to add to the list of clips that would mainstream media might be rolling on their 24-hour news programs, would be the clip of the disciples' faces just looking absolutely shocked themselves at what he's doing. And whether it was there and then or whether it was afterwards, implication could be it's afterwards, they're beginning to piece together what actually took place. And Psalm 69, which is one of the most quoted psalms in the New Testament, it made sense to them. The writer there has a passion for God. That passion sees him ostracized. That passion for God sees him in real difficulty in the community, even in family. But there's a zeal and an urgency and a love for God that Psalm 69 speaks of. And what the disciples are correctly piecing together is that messianic psalm, speaking of the Messiah, is fulfilled in Jesus. Because behind the love of Jesus and his activities and at times the anger behind his righteous anger, rather, behind some of the injustices of this world, behind all of that, is this zeal, this all-consuming passion for the glory of God. That's what the disciples saw. And that was going to stay with them. What Jesus saw, what the disciples saw, what we see, or rather what we should see, was to see two things. Number one, we need to see who we're dealing with. That's one of the lessons of this passage. We need to see who we are dealing with. Now, the reason I say that is that we are drawn, who wouldn't be, by Jesus and how he deals tenderly and affectionately with those who are ignored and downtrodden. He is gentle and humble in heart. He has a compassion and a love that no one else has in that sense. And we're drawn to Jesus' heart of compassion. And it's as chapter 1, verse 17, we looked at it a while back before the summer. Jesus is full of grace and full of truth. And we love that way that he is full of grace and how he deals with people. We sometimes forget that there's perfect balance there. He's full of grace and truth. And we sometimes forget that Jesus being full of truth means that when he encounters lies and when he encounters hypocrisy, he's not going to just ignore that. But there's going to well up within him a righteous anger against lies, against hypocrisy, against everything that deviates from truth. Because he's full of grace and he's full of truth. And so for us to understand who Jesus is, we need to make sure that we have the full revelation of the character of Jesus put before us. Jesus is not gentle Jesus, meek and mild. There is righteous anger that Jesus shows. Not losing his temper like I do, maybe you do too, there's none of that. But it is a righteous anger, a controlled anger, because the same heart that is moved with mercy towards those who are in need is the same heart that is moved to a righteous anger when he sees things that are wrong. And for us, we need to make sure that we've got a clear understanding about who Jesus is, that Jesus has righteous anger as well. And Jesus is not merely just going to sit by if we are somehow not absorbing and being focused on the glory of God in the way we ought to as his people. He's not just going to ignore that. Jesus is compassionate and truthful and loving. He is powerful. He is knowledgeable. But he exhibits on many different occasions righteous anger. Righteous anger at the conditions which cause suffering in this world. We need to make sure that our eyesight is clear today and that our eyesight has a very very sharp focus with a clear picture of who Jesus is. It's important. And the second thing that we need to see is that Jesus is, in his body, the meeting place between God and man. Destroy this temple, I'll rebuild it in 3 days. And of course, the disciples, verse 22, the disciples recalled what Jesus said. They believed that Jesus had spoken, they believed the scripture and the words Jesus had spoken about his body. Verse 21, the temple he'd spoken of was his body. That is the meeting place between God and man now. That is the meeting place that this world needs to hear, that however many options there may be in the supermarket of religion, that there is only actually one answer as to where God and man can meet, and that is in the body of Jesus Christ. That is in the one who is the fullness of the deity dwelling in him. That he is the one through whom the people of God will worship acceptably. He is the one who has fulfilled and superseded all that the work of the physical temple required. He is the mediator, the only mediator between God and man. It is the man Christ Jesus. There is no hope for us in trying to engage or relate to God in any other way apart from through Jesus. And so where everybody would have gathered to a location in the past, we gather to a person in the present. And until he comes back, we gather to a person because we meet Jesus. And he is the one who enables us to relate to God. He is the meeting place between God and man. So with that in mind, what's our takeaways from this section today? I think there's probably two for us. Number one, it is a question. How do we worship? How do we worship? How do we view worship? How do we engage in worship? How do we prepare for worship? Where does it feature on your radar? You see, none of us want to necessarily admit this, but probably all of us, at one point or another, it might describe you right now, it might describe me right now, that we've lost something of the awe and majesty of the consuming glory of who God is. And so that means that we as the temple of God, that we as the temple of God can actually mirror what's going on in chapter 2 here. And it's not animals and it's not money changers and all that stuff. But you've got the whole amusements of suburban, secular, Scottish living. And we can be in a place of worship, and the wonder and majesty of God is just, it's not in our thinking. Because in our thinking, we've got work tomorrow. We get things we did last week. That person said that to me the other day. I need to somehow sort this issue out. And all of the things that, by comparison, and I say this kind of loadily, by comparison are trivial. Now, I know some of us carry burdens in here that are crushing, and I'm not trying to minimize or trivialize these at all. They are crushing. But even our crushing burdens, in comparison to the glory of God, we need to really assess what's going on in our hearts, what's going on in the temple where God has taken up residence when it comes to worship. You see, just taking it or leaving it is... taking or leaving worship is just really not an option, because this is crucial. This is the highest form of activity that any of us can ever be engaged in. So how do you view worship? How do you prepare for worship? I suppose the question should be asked, how often do you attend worship? Where does it feature on your radar? Jesus is making it clear here that his passion, his zeal, is for the worship of God. May he give to us a similar zeal and passion. So that's the first takeaway. How do we view worship? And our final takeaway is, how do we view ourselves? And I know they're connected, but they're slightly different. How do we view ourselves? Because I suppose some of us in here need to actually go right back to the very start of what it is to recognize that there is only one mediator between God and man, Jesus Christ. And you and I, by nature and by practice, there is no way that we are in a right relationship with God. We have rebelled and rejected God. We've ignored him in the world he's created. We've turned around to God and said, no, we're not having your ways or your word or your son. We're doing it our way. And what we need to realize that it means that there is this revolting, enormous burden of sin that we're carrying. And when we recognize that, we need to come to Jesus for cleansing. Isn't that what happened with the leper in Matthew chapter 8? Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Maybe that's what needs to happen for you today. Maybe you need to be cleansed for the first time. And the forgiveness that comes as Jesus washes away all of your sin with the blood that he shed on the cross at Calvary. Maybe you need to come to him and say, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Or maybe we've already begun that path of faith, that relationship with God, and for us, it's not the beginning of that, but it's Lord, you need to cleanse me again. You need to cleanse me again, Lord. Please cleanse this temple. Make it what it should be. And I just want to put one word of warning here as well, that we always take this almost whip that Jesus used, and we take it to ourselves. We don't look at others. in that sense. You know, the easy thing for us to do is maybe kind of sit back and say, well, I really hope this person listened to this whole idea about what worship is and what worship isn't. I really hope this person is taking on board, you know, what it is about Jesus and how they need to actually recognize who they're dealing with here. And the thing is, it's not for us to use the whip against someone else. You leave that to Jesus. You leave them to Jesus. Just focus on yourself and what needs to happen in the cleansing of our own hearts and our own temples before God. So what does Jesus see? Toxic combination, hypocrisy, injustice. He doesn't walk on by. What does Jesus see? Opposition for the first time. It's going to follow him right to the very end. What does Jesus see? Right into your heart and mine. What does the disciples see? Well, they see the fulfillment of the promise of God. This is the Messiah. He has passion for the glory and worship of God, even if he's alone in that passion. What do we see? We need to realize who we're dealing with, the full-orbed picture of Scripture about who Jesus is. We need to realize he is the meeting place between God and man. And we need to check our view on worship. And we need to check our view of ourselves.